Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, November 3rd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at the weather forecast from KCRG. This comes from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Very slim shower chance for Friday, with quiet weekend to follow. There's a lot to like about the next few days of weather in eastern Iowa, especially during the weekend. We start off Friday with somewhat warmer temperatures than the last few days, with more clouds to go with it. Despite the clouds, the warmer start and a southwest breeze ahead of a weak cold front should be enough to push our highs back into the mid to upper 50s in most locations. That front has the potential to produce a shower or two as it passes through the area, but the chance is quite slim. If you are lucky enough to experience one of these showers, most areas won't. They will be brief and likely provide enough rain to wet the pavement and not much else. Skies turn a bit clearer to start tonight, but conditions will otherwise be pretty typically chilly for early November in the 40s for Friday night's high school football playoff games. Overnight lows hit the low to mid 30s, a little cooler behind the cold front that moves through today. The weekend overall looks pretty decent at this point, with shower chances dwindling so much that we have removed them entirely from the time period from Saturday through Sunday's daytime hours. Saturday will likely have a bit more sunshine than Sunday, with winds picking up into Sunday as well. Highs will be in the low to mid-50s on Saturday and upper 50s to low 60s on Sunday. By Sunday night into early Monday, a few showers could take place as a storm system passes nearby. The best chances will likely stay to our north and east, but we cannot rule them out during this time. This is amid an otherwise warm day on Monday, with lows in the low 50s and highs reaching the low 60s for most of the area. Election day on Tuesday looks solid as far as the weather is concerned, but a few more showers are possible Tuesday night into Wednesday. Again, like the Monday chance, the overall risk is slight, and the amounts from both will be light. Temperatures turn a little cooler behind that midweek storm system, with highs back below normal in the mid to upper 40s. Dry conditions are likely as the work and school week winds down. We turn now to the front page of the Courier and an article titled, Hinson Calls on New Speaker to Prioritize Farm Programs. This story was written by Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican from Iowa, said she remains hopeful Congress will pass legislation yet this year, reauthorizing federal spending for programs supporting U.S. farmers and ranchers, including commodity support and conservation programs and crop insurance. Hinson fielded questions from a group of roughly 50 Iowans on topics ranging from federal spending to energy and agricultural policy to climate change and Social Security during a town hall Wednesday in Atkins, Iowa. The Marion Republican began the hour-long public event touting her work and priorities in Congress. That includes her efforts to try to make federal tax cuts enacted in 2017 permanent for individuals and small businesses, expand the federal child tax credit, and legislation that would reduce funding for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency by 39%, defund diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives at federal agencies, cut funding to the long understaffed Internal Revenue Service, and boost border security, including continued border wall construction. Hinson was among a group of 61 Republican House members who wrote nearly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson urging swift passage of a new farm bill. Quote, simply put, farm and food security is national security, the Republican lawmakers wrote in their letter. Quote, for a mere 1/5 of 1% of federal spending, the farm safety net, including commodity support programs and crop insurance, provides farmers and ranchers the foundation they need to manage risk, pass their farm or ranch down to the next generation, and continue producing the highest quality, lowest cost food, fuel, fiber, and forestry products in the world, unquote. A new report released Wednesday finds the federal government is spending billions on crop failures caused by extreme weather, and it's growing more expensive. Crop insurance payouts surpassed $118 billion nationally between 2001 and 2022 for damage caused by extreme weather like drought, heat, and floods. Hinson said protecting commodity support and crop insurance programs in the next farm bill, quote, is of the utmost importance, unquote. Quote, we need to have a strong safety net in place because a stable food supply is of inherent public interest to our country and to our competitiveness globally, she told the crowd. So I think that there is broad bipartisan support for maintaining those programs and making sure it still exists, unquote. The sprawling legislative package that's reauthorized every 5 years also supports agriculture research, rural development, conservation, SNAP benefits, once called food stamps, and more. The current farm bill expired September 30th. However, expiration of the legislation will not truly be felt until the beginning of next year, when some farm policies could revert to controls on production and costly price supports adopted in the 1930s and 1940s. Other programs, such as crop insurance and food assistance programs, are permanently authorized and not affected by the lapse, according to the Congressional Research Service. Passage of a new farm bill has been held up by Congress's inability to agree on federal spending limits in order to avoid a looming government shutdown and House Republican infighting that led to the historic ouster of the former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. The power struggle between McCarthy and the hardline GOP lawmakers left the chamber essentially paralyzed for 3 weeks as the Republican conference tried and failed to coalesce behind a new leader before ultimately uniting around Johnson. Hinson was asked how Johnson plans to deal with party infighting and the rule he inherited from McCarthy that leaves him vulnerable to being ousted. Hinson said she's had conversations with House colleagues about the need to revisit its rules and mechanisms for ousting a speaker. In order to appease the hardline House Freedom Caucus and secure the speakership, one of the major concessions McCarthy made was to reinstate a procedural mechanism called the motion to vacate the chair, which allows a single member to call a vote to ouster the speaker. Hinson said she supports a mechanism to hold leadership accountable, but favors raising the threshold to trigger removal of the House Speaker to a certain percentage of members. Florida Republican U.S. Representative Matt Gaetz, 7 other Republicans, and all House Democrats voted to remove McCarthy, making it the first time in U.S. history a House Speaker was ousted by such a motion. Quote, I hope some people learned a very serious lesson about the damage that did not only to the institution, but to the country as well, said Hinson, who supported retaining McCarthy as Speaker and later backed Johnson. Aaron Brecht, food donor manager at Hawkeye Area Community Action Program's Food Reservoir, asked Hinson about the status of funding for the Emergency Food Assistance Program included in the Farm Bill. Brecht said later, the program is integral to the food bank's operations as food insecurity increases and sustainable access to local produce becomes more critical to meet the needs of families with high inflation and other economic factors contributing to rising grocery, energy, and housing costs. Quote, there is an increased need throughout your charitable food program, he said. Quote, in our last quarter, we went from 100,000 individuals receiving food assistance to about 130,000. We got a lot of support through the USDA Emergency Food Assistance Program. It's been increased in the last year, so we're happy about that, but we want to see the funding stay there so we can continue to serve our neighbors in need in eastern Iowa, unquote. Hinson said she is a big supporter of the programs HACAP offers, and the last thing I want is Iowans to go hungry, unquote. As for the farm bill, Hinson said, quote, it's probably next on our agenda after we get through appropriations bills. She added that she has not heard a whole lot of red flags from anyone on food assistance programs in the farm bill. House Republican lawmakers, however, have proposed new work requirements on food stamp recipients for those ages 50 to 54 as part of a debt ceiling deal. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimates that would put nearly 750,000 older adults who may be more likely to struggle to find a job at risk of losing food assistance. House Republicans have also proposed cuts in spending for food assistance programs for children and seniors as part of the Agriculture Appropriations Bill for fiscal year 2024. The proposed bill included a $32 billion decrease in mandatory SNAP spending from fiscal year 23 levels due to the end of increased pandemic-era benefits and a decrease in participation rates. Quote, during the pandemic, we saw a huge amount of increase everywhere across the board, so we're just trying to make sure those numbers are right where we are right now, Hinson said. Our goal is to get Farm Bill hopefully on the floor in December. If we are not able to get there, my guess is we'll be looking at an extension of some kind, unquote. State audit details uncollected funds, illegal gifts, totaling $17,000. Story filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. More than $17,000 in uncollected funds owed to the state, $1,700 in improperly accepted gifts, and a missing set of Apple AirPod Pros were tied to a former state employee in a new state audit report published Wednesday. The state audit, which covered 2020 through 2022, identified $17,206 in uncollected dues to the state owed by organizations of boxing, kickboxing, mixed martial arts, and wrestling events held in Iowa. That total included $12,925 in license fees and $4,281 in taxes that were not properly claimed and recorded, according to the audit. The Iowa Athletic Commission, a division of Iowa Workforce Development, is responsible for collecting fees and taxes for sporting events hosted in Iowa. The IAC worker responsible for those duties at the time covered in the audit was former IAC program planner Don Chamberlain, according to the audit. A whistleblower in November 2022 alerted state officials to possible wrongdoing by Chamberlain. Iowa Workforce Development conducted an internal investigation, and Chamberlain was discharged in December 2022, according to the audit. In January, Iowa Workforce Development notified the state auditor, attorney general, and Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board of its investigation. The auditor's office at that point began its investigation. Quote, when someone who's supposed to be protecting the public interest and working for the public starts taking personal payments and starts putting their own interests ahead of their job duties and what they're supposed to be doing, just makes me sick to my stomach, Iowa Auditor Rob Sand said Wednesday during a news conference. Quote, it's exactly the kind of thing that undermines trust in our system of self-governance, unquote. The audit also found that Chamberlain violated state law by improperly accepting gifts totaling $1,742. According to the audit, Chamberlain accepted $1,000 in cash to attend an athletic event as an event deputy and was compensated $742 in airfare and hotel accommodations to attend a bare-knuckle fighting event in Denver, according to the audit. The audit also found that Chamberlain, on multiple occasions, misrepresented her position in state government, communicated through proper channels, and used her personal accounts to complete financial transactions for the state. Quote, that intermingling of public money and public obligations and the personal is always entirely unacceptable, Sand said during the news conference. Quote, it can be tempting to use Venmo because it's a convenient tool, but you have to know everybody knows that you do not intermingle your personal accounts with state business. That is just never, ever, ever appropriate. Quote, just because it's inconvenient to properly oversee financial transactions doesn't mean that a state employee should ever go and start using their personal account. Oh, just Venmo me and I'll take care of it. That's a recipe for corruption, unquote. The audit also found that a set of Apple AirPod Pro earbuds purchased for $175 in June 2022 and assigned to Chamberlain were reported missing and never recovered. Quote, we are proud to say the process of detecting fraud worked, beginning with Iowa Workforce Development, a department spokesman said via email. Quote, procedures and controls have since been improved at the Iowa Athletic Commission, and we are confident, with confirmation from the Department of Inspections and Licensing, that the improvements will continue under DIAL. The Iowa Athletic Commission was moved from Iowa Workforce Development to the new Department of Inspections and Appeals on July 1st as part of a reorganization of the executive branch of state government. Sand said his office has notified the Polk County Attorney's Office of the audit and that the county attorney or Iowa Attorney General can determine whether to take legal action. Mobile ID app ready for state to download. It is companion to physical card, but not a replacement. Story filed by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, and the dateline is Des Moines. Iowans can now download an app that can be used as a digital version of their driver's license at businesses across the state. The Iowa Mobile ID app can be used to verify a person's age for purchasing alcohol and tobacco, as well as for identification at certain TSA pre-check checkpoints at Iowa airports. Quote, Iowa is the first state in the nation to roll out a mobile ID with a large number of businesses across the state capable of accepting the ID, Governor Kim Reynolds said in an Iowa DOT release. Quote, I'm so proud of the DOT and the Department of Revenue's Alcoholic Beverages Division, working together on an innovative solution that provides convenience and added security for Iowans as they use their IDs for a variety of purposes, unquote. The app was originally slated for release in 2022, but new updates in technology and best practices delayed the development of the app. The app is now available for download on both the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. Quote, innovation and technology underpin our work to make lives better through transportation, and I am pleased to showcase another example of this from our department, Iowa DOT said in a statement. According to the DOT release, the app is, quote, a companion to the physical card and does not replace it. The agency said Iowans should still carry their physical card. Where can it be used? The app can be accepted by businesses that use the Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division Age to Purchase app. Iowa Department of Revenue Director Mary Mossaman said in the release that integrating the two apps will lead to quicker adoption. So far, 18 businesses have told the DOT that they're ready to accept the mobile ID, according to a list on the agency's website. Iowa residents can also use the mobile ID at TSA PreCheck at the Des Moines International Airport, Eastern Iowa Airport, and many other airports throughout the country. Other businesses that use the ID verification app will be able to accept Iowa Mobile ID. Iowans should look for the Iowa Mobile ID logo on businesses' doors and at point of sale, the agency said. As with any new technology, the transition to widespread use will ramp up over time, the agency said in the release. The app cannot be used as a valid form of ID when voting, a spokesperson from the Iowa Secretary of State, Paul Pate, said. How do I set it up? After downloading the app, users will be asked to register with their phone number and scan their physical ID. Users will then need to submit a photo of themselves to verify their identity. Users will be asked to create a PIN or use biometrics to secure their mobile ID. When asked to present their ID, a mobile ID user can click a button in the app to share their identity, which will pull up a QR code that the businesses can scan. They will then be asked to accept or reject the business's request for their information. Users can also choose how much information to share. For example, they can share their age with the business without revealing their address. Quote, how is data secured? According to the DOT's website, the mobile ID app does not permanently store personal data, other than an encrypted version of the user's driver's license number and phone number as a record locator. The information accessed by the app is stored with the Iowa DOT. Now let's turn to the sports page. In college football, UNI returns home for final battle with Western Illinois as conference foes. Story was written by Ethan Petrick. Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa welcomes Western Illinois to the Unidome for the final time as Missouri Valley Football Conference opponents on Saturday. When the Panthers line up across from the Leatherbacks, it will function as the final chapter of nearly 40 years and 36 games worth of history between the two programs as Western Illinois departs for the Ohio Valley Conference after the 2023 season. It is not a rivalry UNI head coach Mark Farley looks forward to losing. Quote, they were in the original four-man Gateway Football Conference, Farley said. This is a big move for them. It is a big move for our league, and it is definitely a factor in the University of Northern Iowa because of the distance. That trip is not that far away. That is like an in-state game for both. When you start talking budgets and travel, that is a big deal for everybody. That is a game we do not want to lose. I will schedule that game as much as they want to play that game, unquote. That is a game we need on our schedule. I hope they feel the same way about it on their schedule. But on the same time, it is two different leagues. That has always been a great game down there, up here. They have had some great players over all the years and some very good teams, unquote. Without a doubt in his mind, Farley added that Western Illinois provided the MVFC a lot over the course of its membership in the league. UNI holds the advantage in all-time meetings, 35-16, and conference meetings, 26-10. The Panthers faced the Leathernecks every season for the past 45 years. As they prepare for the 46th consecutive meeting, Farley said UNI will not overlook the winless Leathernecks despite their lack of recent success. Western Illinois has not won a game in over 2 years, and lost their previous four games by a combined score of 212-24. Farley specifically pointed to the Leathernecks' 34-18 loss to Illinois State in Week 2 as the reason to look beyond this week. Quote, they took Illinois State the whole game, Farley said. Quote, I studied that game a lot for the Illinois State game because that Western Illinois was doing to Illinois State. It is as good a team as anybody on any given Saturday, unquote. UNI defensive coordinator Jeremiah Johnson noted the Leathernecks feature a number of talented players, namely quarterback Matt Morrissey, who transferred to Western Illinois this offseason after spending 2 seasons at UNI. Quote, "Matt is a good athlete, and he has a really strong arm," Johnson said. "He does a good job of putting the ball where he wants. They have 2 wide receivers that he uses a lot. I think he knows where he is going, and they let him get rid of that thing pretty quickly," unquote. Morrissey put up 1,590 passing yards and 10 touchdowns through 8 games as the Leathernecks' starting quarterback. As noted by Johnson, Morrissey went to wide receivers Jalen Jackson and Parker Jay on 48.4% of his completions. Farley advised that the Panthers need to stay grounded and continue focusing on how they can get better this week instead of focusing on or overlooking their opponent. Quote, "We just have to keep the shovel out and keep digging our way out of this and not worry about what is going on around us," Farley said. Quote, "Just keep your head down and keep digging." For the Panthers, continuing to dig takes the shape of building off back-to-back standout defense showings and relatively clean offense performances in wins over North Dakota and Illinois State. The Panthers own a 51-21 scoring margin over the previous 2 games and dominated possessions against Fighting Hawks and Redbirds. The Panthers own a +2 turnover margin in the last 2 games. Johnson said UNI started playing really fast against North Dakota and continued that execution into last week's win. Quote, "They are starting to trust themselves and trust one another," Johnson said. "We are just playing a lot different speed than we were earlier. We are not thinking as much. We are able to just go play. Obviously, that has helped us the last couple of weeks," unquote. Johnson sees no reason for UNI not to continue playing that way. Quote, "Success and feeling that you get when you play really well is kind of euphoric," Johnson said. "I think these guys are liking what they are doing right now. They like what they are doing. I think they want to continue to build off of it," unquote. Under the injury report, running back Ty Edwards returned to action against Illinois State after missing back-to-back games after sustaining an injury against Indiana State. Despite Edwards' return, Amuri Pesek-Hickson continued to serve as the number one running back for the Panthers. Freshman wide receiver Jaden Ellis-Leahy also returned against Illinois State after missing 1 game due to a concussion suffered against South Dakota State. Quote, "That helped having him back," Farley said. "It was nice to see Ty back again, but we are still getting through the injuries on that side of the ball," unquote. Defensive lineman Cordarius Bailey also saw the field after missing the final 3 quarters of action against North Dakota the week prior. Tight end Lane Pryor remains out, as does defensive back Tate Sander and linebacker Ben Belkin. Farley did not provide a clear timeline on any player's return from injury, though he noted Belkin is starting to come back now, unquote. As for the poll watch, the Panthers made their return to the top 25 of the FCS coaches poll, coming at number 23 in the ranking. 6 MVFC teams appeared in the standings, with UNI the final one to earn a spot. The Panthers trail number 1 South Dakota State, number 10 North Dakota State, number 11 Southern Illinois, number 12 South Dakota, and number 15 North Dakota. Youngstown State and Illinois State finished outside the poll with 44 votes and 7 votes, respectively. In the Stats Perform FCS poll, voted on by a national media panel, UNI rose to 5 spots to number 18 with 389 points. 7 MVFC teams appeared in the media poll with the same quintet above UNI and Youngstown State slotting in at number 22. The FCS playoff committee announced a mid-season top 10 ranking on Thursday, October 26th. South Dakota State took the top spot, while South Dakota appeared at number 4. And now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, November 3rd, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. For our first editorial, we begin with a reminder that Daylight Savings Time ends this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock a.m. That means you'll want to turn your clocks back 1 hour before you go to bed on Saturday night. And here we have an article titled, How to Fall Back Without Missing a Beat. This was written by Holly Burns and appeared in the New York Times. The transition to fall is scattered with seasonal markers. The occasional chill in the air, the wearing of the flannel shirt to the pumpkin patch, the urge to make soup. These changes so far have happened like clockwork, and next comes the one that actually involves clocks. On Sunday, November 5th, people in the United States and Canada will, quote, fall back to standard time, setting their clocks back an hour and signaling the end of daylight savings time. Hawaii and most of Arizona, which are on permanent standard time, keep their clocks the same. Most Americans dislike this twice-yearly time reset, according to various polls, and it may soon end. In 2022, the Senate passed legislation to make daylight savings time permanent, but it has largely stalled in the House of Representatives. Canada has passed a similar bill, contingent on the U.S. making a change, and Mexico has ended its time changes as well. For now, most of us will be making the switch. And while many scientists maintain that standard time is better aligned with human circadian biology, even a modest time adjustment can take some getting used to, particularly when it means shorter, darker days. The extra hour of afternoon darkness can be especially hard for people who are, quote, vulnerable to feeling down in the autumn and winter, which is an awful lot of people, unquote, said Norman E. Rosenthal, a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Georgetown University School of Medicine, who coined the term seasonal affective disorder. Quote, they may be low energy, lethargic, prone to overeating, and just out of sorts for a while, unquote. Here's how to prepare for the change and the darker season to come. Embrace the extra hour of sleep. Many people, if they're not working the night shift or parenting a small child, will get an extra hour of sleep on the morning after the clocks change. And that's, quote, going to enable them to function better, said Elizabeth B. Clearman, a professor of neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. More than a third of the Americans are sleep deprived, which can have detrimental effects on mood, memory, and health. If you can't sleep the extra hour, or you just want a smoother transition, try shifting your bedtime 30 minutes later a few days in advance, so that by Sunday, the time on the clock is closer to the time your body feels it is, said Jennifer Martin, a professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, and president of the board of directors for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. That means, though, that you should also be sleeping 30 minutes later in the mornings, which isn't feasible for everyone. For what it's worth, you can try this with your kids, too. Extra time in bed sounds glorious to some, but it can be hard if you struggle with insomnia, said Dr. Martin, because the night basically just got an hour longer. In that case, focus on keeping the time you spend in bed the same, rather than the time you fall asleep. So if you usually spend 8 hours in bed, say, between 10:30 p.m. and 6:30 a.m., go to bed an hour later on Saturday night, which may reduce your chances of lying awake during the night. Move your workout. It can be demoralizing to find that the pleasant afternoon stroll you've been accustomed to is now a gloomy trudge through the dark. Shifting your walk, run, or bike ride to the morning means you'll get a dose of direct morning light, which is important for regulating sleeping and waking habits. Your cortisol spikes, giving you energy, and your brain stops producing the sleep hormone melatonin. Quote, morning light is how your body clock resets itself to the outside world, Dr. Clearman explained. Of course, exercising first thing in the morning may be chillier. One trick is to do a quick warm-up inside with an extra layer over your workout clothes. Then remove it right before you leave the house, said Tom Manning, a coach with fitness app Future. Quote, that creates a pocket of insulation between your body and your first layer that'll keep you warmer once you're outside, unquote. If a morning workout feels particularly daunting on a dreary day, Jennifer Jacobs recommends psyching yourself up with something she calls the morning bounce. Quote, put on a song, anything that makes you want to move, and lightly bounce on the balls of your feet for the whole thing, said Ms. Jacobs, a Miami-based personal trainer and the founder of fitness program Job One. Quote, if you can be barefoot, you can be in your pajamas. Just start the day with some movement and see how you feel from there, unquote. If you can't swing a morning workout, think about embracing the evening darkness and doing things outside that might give you a new perspective on your environment, said Katie Hill, a psychiatrist and chief medical officer at wellness company Nuge Health. If the climate allows, and you have somewhere safe to do it, that could mean shooting hoops with a light-up basketball or bundling up and going on a night hike when there's a full moon, unquote. But since you may be hitting the day a little earlier for the first few days after the clocks change, don't leave it too late to work out. Exercising close to bedtime can make it really hard to fall asleep, said Dr. Martin. Eat with care. Aim to stick to your normal meal times once the clocks change. So if you were eating dinner at 6:30 p.m., keep eating at 6:30 p.m., said Haley Wilkes, an integrative nutritionalist at Chicago who works with clients to navigate potential disruptions to their eating habits. Prepare the week before by gradually shifting meal times forward 15 minutes so your body gets used to eating a little later. Shifting into shorter, darker days can impact the way we eat, Ms. Wilkins said. Quote, some people will feel themselves a little sleepier in the afternoons, a little snackier, unquote. If you're suddenly hungry at an odd time, choose a snack that is high in protein or fat and pair it with a complex carbohydrate containing fiber, which is digested slowly and won't prompt a blood sugar spike. An apple with nut butter or cheese with whole grain crackers are good choices, Ms. Wilkes said. Lastly, watch your caffeine and alcohol consumption in the days after the time change. It's no secret that both can worsen sleep quality. So, quote, if you're having trouble adjusting, it's a good time to be careful, said Dr. Martin. Seek creative activities. In the days after we put the clocks back, it's natural to feel sad that summer is over or frustrated that some activities aren't an option anymore, Dr. Hill said. A Danish study of more than 185 people over 17 years found that the transition to standard time was associated with an 11% increase in depressive episodes. As it gets colder and darker, it may be tempting to indulge in nothing more mentally taxing than a Netflix binge. But sedentary behavior and media consumption are strongly associated with decreased life satisfaction and increased depression, said Dr. Hill. Instead, try to focus on activities where you create rather than consume. That might look like staging a family puppet show, something she did with her own children last week, or signing up for an art or cooking class. It can also be useful, she said, to, quote, think about the positives that you can add to your life, rather than just focusing on what you've lost as the summer leaves. Winter can be a wonderful time for restoring ourselves, exploring new hobbies and experiences, and emerging in the spring more interesting, healthy, and satisfied. Holly Burns is a writer in the San Francisco Bay Area and a frequent contributor to the New York Times. The next opinion piece is titled simply Jeff Tweedy, and it appeared in the New York Times yesterday. It's important to admit when you're wrong, and though I once bristled at the notion that there could ever be such a thing as a wrong musical opinion, I have since come to accept that there is, in fact, such a thing. I know because I had one. I was colossally wrong about the song Dancing Queen by ABBA. I'm happy I can admit it, maybe even a touch proud of myself for not digging in my heels and hating this song for even a second longer than I had to, unlike some of my friends who are still holding out. To me, looking back, the weirdest part is ever feeling that I had to hate something so clearly irresistible. In a way, I blame the time and place where I grew up. At the time Dancing Queen came out in 1976, there were very strict lines in the sand being drawn between cultural camps. This tune was situated deep in, quote, enemy territory at the intersection of pop and disco. I'm not sure if I would say that I hated it, but the truth is I hated a lot of music growing up. I am perhaps a bit skeptical by nature, but scanning the horizons of my memory, seeing what I saw around me from about the mid-70s to the late 80s, I'd say I was just a kid. And at that particular nanosecond of geological time, kids hated stuff. In particular, my group of friends and I despised a lot of music, and by extension, the morons who would dare admit that they liked something we hated. Music, can you believe it? We were somehow able to conjure vein-bulging fury at the mere mention of a band like Styx. Why did we feel this way? Mostly, I think, because hating certain music gave us a way of defining ourselves. Our identities were indistinct, and drawing a line around the music we liked made our young hearts feel whole. Liking punk rock made us unique. I won't even get into the subgenres, schisms, and sects that created their own punk microtribes. By the same token, not liking punk rock gave purpose to kids who wore Foreigner t-shirts and carried giant combs in their back pockets. The divisions we created were embarrassing. I have sometimes even wondered if these youthful scrimmages over musical taste weren't a kind of childhood version of the current situation our country now finds itself in. Were people of my generation so good at dividing ourselves into factions based on stupid, insignificant differences that we simply never stopped doing it? Someone smarter than me has probably mapped the parallels between Journey fans and X fans and the current binary of political right and left. Or if no one has, someone should. I'd like to think that I have a more mature perspective now. I've worked hard to open my mind and keep it open. But at the time that Dancing Queen came out, I was still too young to think of myself as anything, much less a punk rocker. So this song ended up getting a double whammy of scorn. The initial provincial disco panic, and then the evolved and curatorial hate that guarded the borders of my sense of self from anything that didn't clear the low, low bar of punk music. Initially hating this song and ABBA in general didn't really feel like a choice. Gagging at the mere mention of this sweet little quartet was just being, you know, normal. And at the time that Dancing Queen came out, it wasn't hard to hate a disco song anyway. Disco was despised by practically everyone I knew, with the exception of the kids who liked to roller skate. Basically, meaning that to all of the males older than myself, in my extended family sphere, disco, and by extension, the culture it was reputed to promote, had taken on the profile of something legitimately wrong, a world-destroying force that we must all unite against. And, of course, most of this provincial hand-wringing really centered around one adjective I'd never heard applied to music. Disco was, quote, gay. And to 9-year-old boys who didn't know any better, gay meant bad. Add to this the fact that, musically, disco was a technology embracing reinterpretation of Black American music forms that, as a movement, seemed to be utterly ignoring the traditional American racial divide, which made some people very uncomfortable, and, well, it was just too much ignorance for even the most confident child, which I was not, to sort through and reject. I'd like to take a moment here to make clear to you, the reader, that I do understand the band I'm talking about here was and is white, Swedish, so white, and straight. It doesn't matter, or at least it didn't matter at the time, because it was disco. It was thoroughly demonized, and for all the wrong reasons. And so, because of all the societal forces at play, and because of my own weakness, I never allowed myself to like it. Even after my initial introduction and their subsequent failure to actually destroy our way of life, ABBA's exhilarating pop perfection languished in a roped-off part of my brain. Then, finally, years later, after I'd already started trying to write songs, I went grocery shopping one day and found myself standing in an aisle and staring at an overhead speaker, not stoned, just reeling at this familiar melody and how exuberantly sad it was, having the time of your life. It was a real come-to-Jesus moment, a come-to-Agnetha, Bjorn, Benny, and Annie Fried moment. Before that day, I, along with many others, had denied myself the undeniable joy. Countless fantastic records and deep grooves were dismissed and derided out of ignorance. But, of course, this song and this music was always going to win eventually, because it's just too special to ignore forever. Over time, several other artists that had previously been exiled were also later re-evaluated and accepted. Neil Young comes to mind. Believe it or not, my friends and I once rejected his entire catalog as hippie drivel. But Mr. Young picked the lock on the cage we'd put him in with the single most irresistible force in our young male minds, an electric guitar played at an irresistible volume. These days, whenever I think I dislike a piece of music, I think about Dancing Queen and am humbled. That song taught me that I can't ever completely trust my negative reactions. I was burned so badly by this one song being withheld from my heart for so long. I try to never listen to music now without first examining my own mind and politely asking whatever blind spots I'm afflicted with to move aside long enough for my gut to be the judge. And even then, if I don't like something, I make a mental note to try it again in 10 years. Melodies as pure and evocative as the one in Dancing Queen don't come along every day, and I mourn every single moment I missed loving this song, playing it again as I write this, making up for lost spins. I feel overcome with gratitude for its existence. So, if you take anything away from this, I hope it will be this recommendation. Spend some time looking for a song, or a book, or a film, or a painting, or a person you might have unfairly maligned. It feels really good to stop hating something, and music is a good place to start, because while records don't change over time, we can and do. Better late than never. And here's a note to the listener. Jeff Tweedy is the singer and guitarist of the band Wilco, and the author of World Within a Song, Music That Changed My Life, and The Life That Changed My Music, from which this essay is adapted. Now from the Capital Dispatch, journalist Jacob Fischler, state and local election workers are quitting amid abuse, officials tell U.S. Senate panel. State and local election officials face threats and intimidation, driving experienced workers out of the profession, a panel of election officials told a U.S. Senate committee on Wednesday. Conspiracy theories have fueled a more hostile environment for election workers, which has led many to quit, creating more challenges for the inexperienced new leaders. The top election officials from two background states testified at a U.S. Senate Rules and Administration Committee hearing on threats to election administration. Democratic and Republican election workers have been the targets of threats and abusive conduct, Rules Committee Chair Amy Klobuchar, a Minnesota Democrat, said. Senators stressed the bipartisan nature of the issue, and neither members of the committee nor the election administrator witnesses, which included state officials from Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Nebraska, and the Rutherford County, Tennessee, Administrator of Elections, mentioned former President Donald Trump or his unfounded attempts to discredit the 2020 election results that led to the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Congress must, quote, continue the federal funding and to make clear this is a bipartisan, nonpartisan piece of the work that we do, Klobuchar said. Quote, in recent years, election officials have faced both cybersecurity threats and physical threats, the panel's ranking Republican, Nebraska's Deb Fisher, said. They have struggled to retain experienced poll workers and to recruit and train new poll workers, unquote. Threats against election workers and related issues have worsened since 2020, senators and witnesses said. 12 of Arizona's 15 counties lost their chief election official in the last 3 years. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, a Democrat, told the committee, quote, as a former county recorder myself, I can attest that the pre-2020 world for election administrators is gone, he said. Quote, we don't feel safe in our work because of the harassment and threats that are based in lies, unquote. He urged action to combat the misinformation that has led to distrust of election officials, calling it, quote, a threat to American democracy. Quote, many veteran Arizona officials from both political parties have left the profession for the sake of their own physical, mental, and emotional health and that of their families, Fontes said. Quote, the cost of persistent misrepresentations about the integrity of our elections is high, but the cost of inaction against those threats is higher, unquote. More than 50 top officials resigned over the same period in Pennsylvania, Klobuchar said. The entire staff of the election officials in Buckingham County, Virginia, left earlier this year, she added. Conspiracy theories feed difficult environment. But the election administrators from the states with more contested elections said threats have increased in recent years, fueled largely by the types of unfounded conspiracy theories that Trump espoused. Administrators should take seriously the legitimate threats to election integrity, which is a real issue, Smith, whom Trump personally attacked for his work overseeing Philadelphia's 2020 election results, said. But conspiracy theorists who claim to be concerned with election integrity often promote wildly absurd ideas, he said, adding that such claims were particularly numerous about Philadelphia in the 2020 cycle. Quote, I can't begin to share the number in Philadelphia that we experienced in 2020, that if it were a movie, you'd walk out. It's just so dumb, Smith said. But a lot of people believe it. Georgia Democrat John Ossoff said conspiracy theories led to 65,000 voter registration challenges in just 8 counties in his state in the lead up to the 2020 midterms. The challenges were, quote, overwhelmingly frivolous and targeted black voters, Ossoff said. Fontes urged a more aggressive posture to fight misinformation. Quote, I think we need to be very, very much more robust in attacking the illegitimate attacks for what they are, conspiracy theories and lies designed to undermine our democracy, Fontes said. And here's a note to the listener. Iowa Capital Dispatch is part of States Newsroom, a network of news bureaus supported by grants and a coalition of donors, as a 501c3 public charity. Iowa Capital Dispatch maintains editorial independence. Woman arrested for theft from UNI student group. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Cedar Falls. A University of Northern Iowa student has been arrested for allegedly using a student organization's debit card to make personal purchases, including airline travel and Major League Baseball tickets. Courtney Page Jarrett, 22, was arrested Wednesday morning on 3 counts each of second-degree theft and unauthorized use of a credit card. She was released from jail pending trial. The case was investigated by the University of Northern Iowa Department of Public Safety. The student organization wasn't named in court records, but the Children's Miracle Network website shows Jared was on the executive board of the University of Northern Iowa Dance Marathon, which raises money for children's hospitals. According to court records, UNI police received a report concerning a student organization on September 8th, and investigators interviewed Jared about a week later. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, November 3rd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we hope you're enjoying this warmer weather and that you have a great weekend. We want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.